The College Game Day podcast is presented by Old Dominion Freight Line, helping the world keep promises.
We got a real simple plan. One me and one mission.
Georgia has won the national championship. Touchdown!
If you're a fan, you might think this is sports heaven.
This might be college football heaven. Yeah.
This is ESPN's College Game Day podcast. Now alongside Pete Thamel, here's Reese Davis.
Another weekend, another coach gets whacked. After Herm, who's next? A couple of bandwagons hit some really nasty potholes, and Appalachian State might have the most memorable September in recent history. This is the College Game Day podcast for Monday, September 19th. I'm Reese Davis. Pete Thamel is here as well. And before we turn the page into next week, I think it is perfectly fitting if we go back and reminisce a bit about our trip to Boone. I'd never been to Appalachian State before, Pete. It was everything they built it to be, from the quaintness of the town to the rabid fan base to the food to the promise of the fans camping out the night before. I signed a dude's forehead. Actually, I signed one dude's forehead and one dude's cheek. The upper one, thankfully, I would have declined an offer for a lower cheek. It was a great scene, and they almost messed it up by blowing the game, and then they win the thing on a Hail Mary. So if you're keeping score at home, they've got a 40-point fourth quarter and a near miss on a two-point conversion that would have won the game against Carolina. They have a win on the road in one of the most hostile environments in the sport against the number six team in the country. And just for good measure, let's win the first conference game after College Game Day on an improbable Hail Mary, as if any Hail Mary is probable. That one was particularly improbable given what they had done leading up to it. So it was a remarkable weekend and a remarkable Saturday at App State.
So I'm going to start on the field and then we can go off the field. So I left App State, of course, because when like a once a decade finish happens and you're on the field in pregame, what great journalism instincts did I have? I drove to Wake Forest and saw a great game. The Liberty had a 2-point conversion with about a minute to go to win it that failed. So I was certainly not disappointed in my trip to Wake, but I was watching App State and Troy in the press box and really like regretting all journalism instincts that took me 90 miles away from what remained the biggest story of the day after game day shut down there. The play that App State ran is known as Big Ben, and it a little bit is the football version, Reese, of the Valpo play where they won it, where you throw the Hail Mary inside and then kick it out to like the streak. Mm-hmm. It's now again, it's different than that, right? Mm-hmm. But the point was they had a receiver go up and tip it. And then the receiver who caught it ended up, I mean, he was like untouched. Like he didn't have to go through it. He sprinted to the end zone. And there's, you can see on some of the replays, the Troy athletic director, Brent Jones, screaming, no, like in a frozen shot there as he just watched like what could have been for John Summerall, who brought his team there and did a heck of a job, going for 59 minutes and 58 seconds, and they really played well. You could just see all that slipping away. But Kevin Barbet, the OC, was at Florida 5 years ago. They ran a version of Big Ben where Florida walked off against Tennessee. If you remember the Felipe Franks to Tyree Cleveland, that was Big Ben in. So I have a feeling old Big Ben will be remembered on T-shirts around Boone, murals. They might even make an IPA. The radio guys in a great call called the Miracle on the Mountain Part 2. Yeah, I think they dubbed it. So anyway, it was a remarkable finish. God bless college football and the chaos that ensues. And it was, I think, the perfect cap. I'm surprised. I texted some folks at App State. I was like, I hope the town is still standing on Saturday night.
I had a North Carolina friend, an ardent North Carolina fan who is very familiar with Boone, who said, you know, they call it the high country. He said after that game, it might be the flatlands, but it might just absolutely level the place. Big Ben, do you know the origin of the name of that? Because I don't. I'll tell you when I first remember it. Steve Bartkowski and the Falcons beat the Saints on a Hail Mary that they called Big Ben. That's the first time it came into my consciousness way back when, because I was a Saints fan and despised that. And there were also some blocked punts against Russell Erksleben, who was for some reason, the Saints drafted a punter in the first round 1 year.
If you start talking about that Jacksonville State quarterback, I'm going to get off the pod.
No, you're not. And look, man, I'm just saying, you're the one who brought it. You brought it up because you said it's called Big Ben, as if this is like some new terminology. This is like old school. I was just wondering if you knew. Yeah. I don't. I'm asking our listeners who first called the Hail Mary play Big Ben.
I don't know who called it Big Ben, but it has been borrowed through time because Barbet was at Florida with McElwain when they ran it against Tennessee. And look, every football play is stolen. There are no new football plays, right? They're evolved and everything. So usually they change names because it's like, you know, it was somebody named Ben. But I think it's Big Ben because you need a tip guy. I'm guessing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Big Ben is obviously a giant edifice. And you needed someone to go up and be big. And if they can't catch it in the end zone, and that ball got tipped about the 5 yard line, right? Like, you need somebody to keep it alive to give somebody some room to run. So I don't recall your Big Ben, but I would assume there was a tip involved.
Yeah, it kind of knocked up and they caught it. And it was heartbreaking anyway.
How about the Cal one, by the way, if we're going to go down a Hail Mary rabbit hole. I mean, I did a lot of shrieking in the Wake Forest press box. So I apologize for that. Because, like, you know, you're watching the game on your laptop. It's very quiet in press boxes.
Right,
that's something people don't realize. And it's like, that hit four players.
Yeah.
You know how hard it is for a Hail Mary to hit four players? And that poor Cal receiver laying on the ground. I mean, there was a shot of him looking, you know, desolate after the game. You feel for him, obviously. But he was on the ground. The ball in the end zone was in his two hands, not just one. It was in two of his hands. And Marcus Freeman, man, I hope he enjoyed a long neck ice cold beer on Saturday night, because he earned it the way that game ended.
I would suggest that perhaps more fitting for Marcus after, you know, from what I understand, based on the pictures on the internet, you know, there was a receiving into the Catholic Church. I'm Protestant, not Catholic, so I don't know all the machinations there. But maybe a trip to the grotto would have been more in order. Thankful candle being...
Yes.
Because not only they'd won the game earlier, and then Cal got another chance because of a targeting call. Yeah. And, you know, then there was a whole thing with the spread, you know, where it looked like maybe Notre Dame had returned and scored a touchdown to cover. So that was wild. Before we leave Appalachian State, you promised pre-podcast a story about your new best friend, Luke Combs, as the two of you were chummily backstage awaiting Luke's appearance as a celebrity guest speaker.
So I didn't bother Luke Combs and I didn't introduce myself. And again, he couldn't have been nicer. He took pictures with everybody in our crew who was back up in our office at App. The PR folks, social media folks, hair and makeup folks. If you're a Luke Combs fan listening to this, he was as affable and kind as you would hope he is. And he was genuinely giddy to be there. I certainly don't have the guest picker repertory that you do, but I thought he was as good of as one I've ever seen. Just, you know, detailed knowledge, app by a million. Like, he was, but he knew the sport. And some of our guest pickers may struggle to, like, know the sport. Cough, cough, Jack Harlow. you know, he didn't say dated a girl in Cincinnati. Let's put it that way. So, again, Jack Harlow was great for us. But, like, Luke Combs, like, you could tell, like, he was prepped and ready, and not in a way like he, like, read it off a sheet. You know what I mean? Like, he was built for that. So I go back I had to hit somewhere around 10:30, and I go back to the office, try to, like, make a few more phone calls and whatever. And I go to the restroom. And in the restroom, Luke Combs is changing and he's talking to a security guard, like an App State cop. And I don't like, so yeah, I'm in the bathroom minding my own business. I like don't know it's Luke Combs, right? Like, I just, yeah, I'm not thinking, you know, when you're doing a show and you're as bad on TV as I am and as nervous as I am generally, like, you're not like cognizant of the environment. You're just sort of like minding your own business. And he starts talking and he's like, yeah, I had a show in Wisconsin last night. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. And I'm just minding my own business. And he very genuinely, like, it wasn't an act. And it literally, like, he's changing at the mirror and the cop is in the, you know, in one of the stalls. And he's like, man, if I didn't have a show tonight, I would be out there drinking with all them. Like, he came off as like very genuine and very proud of having gone to App, and a very proud App guy. And I just, like, I will just remember that being like, yeah, this guy's sitting here having to go fly back private and do a show. And just all he wants to do is go in that sea of humanity. Now, did you see the Instagram story Jeff Sims put up of Luke Combs chugging a beer?
I did not see that.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
Yeah, I wonder if it's expired off her stories yet. It will be probably by the time people get the podcast. Let's just say him chugging a beer, it was not the first one he'd chugged. Like there was a professionalism to it that was pretty daunting. And Jess's face, Lindsay, who does Jess's hair and makeup, took the video. And after Luke Combs chugs a beer, and it's like he's like holding up, like not a drop got on his chin. Right? It was an impressive professional job. Jess Sims's face was like, oh my god, did he just do that? Now this is, now mind you, walking out, some random fan hands him a Coors Light. Game Day people may have been very happy it was branded properly.
Absolutely.
And he's just walking to the set, and some, you know, guys, App State students, like, hey, Luke, come chug a beer. Like, it was, I'm trying to think of like the sporting equivalent. It was like as natural as Steph Curry shooting a three in warmups. there was an ease to it and a flow to it. So I admit my Northeast roots. I'm not a huge country guy, but I just, that whole Luke Combs experience, watching him interact, he may have taken a little Yeti and had himself a little whiskey drink before he went on the show to calm his nerves. I was like, this guy's a real guy, man. I was super impressed. And that's one of the neat parts of Game Day, is you get a little peek behind the curtain at some of these folks. But Luke Combs, man, he was aces in every way possible.
You know, absolutely. He was a great guest picker. The art to that, to me, is the people who know the sport, but can also have the Jack Harlow, I dated a girl in Cincinnati moment, which at the end of the day is as good a way as any to try to pick winners in college football games. Yeah. Finding
probably
the balance.
Be better than us thinking about it.
Yeah, no doubt.
Our records.
Yeah. Luke did a tremendous job with that. And the thing that I loved afterwards, because I always push when we get these guys on, if we can get them to perform, that would be sensational. Now, logistically, it wasn't possible this week with Luke Combs, but after the show, they're chanting at him, sing a song. And he looked at me and he said, if I had a way to do it, I would. And I said, if you come back, would you do it? He goes, for sure. And I mean, just a really good dude, new ball, loves Appalachian State. And I think the other thing that's underrated, Desmond and I went to the Chancellor's house for a little reception on Friday night. I was informed there that another great friend of the show and a top-notch guest picker, Eric Church, is not as revered there anymore, because he committed the cardinal sin of doing a promo for North Carolina basketball, an in-stadium promo, and it, something like Let's Go Heels or whatever, and they played it when Appalachian State was in the Dean Dome. So this caused some Appalachian State people to not be as happy with Eric, who, by the way, is a wonderful guy too, terrific guy, and a good guest picker. And in some ways, according to the people that we visited with, that Luke Combs elevates his own status enough, but this elevated him even higher in the eyes of Mountaineer Nation, because there's no ambiguity about where Luke stands on his fan allegiance. Weekend Review is brought to you by Eckrich Smoked Sausage. Find them in the refrigerated meat aisle at your favorite grocery store to create a one-of-a-kind sausage recipe. Many sausage recipes, in fact. Eckrich, you do you.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
Throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
Pete, one more thing about the show. I've started my review process, which I've shared on the podcast a few times, that I go through everything and look at it. When we had we had Sean Clark's audio up, there happens, we have a million mics going on, and I ask you a question and your mic's not working. Your response, man, you're getting more and more comfortable. You're doing great out there. It was funny. You had a great one-liner. I think that shows it. You make fun of yourself about.
Well, there's a lot of material there. So
but you're a smart dude. obviously know your stuff inside out. The tweets are amazing that pop up on the show. But the response there and the comfort and the no panic, you know, I mean, one of the things I try to do on the show is that if the lights fall off the grid above me and crash down right in front of me while I'm doing it on camera, I want to take my arm, push it to the side and say, we're going to get that cleaned up for you. Meanwhile, BYU's got a huge game in your team today. And you did that. You did it with some humor and good grace. And we had some fun with the potential ankle damage that you had leaping off the Air Force bandwagon. By the way, I had to hop off. I just gotten a seat on the BYU bandwagon and I had to disembark quickly.
You could left by halftime.
Yeah, man, that was a bit, but good on you. Really, really well done to handle that. So
no, thank you. I appreciate it. I was probably too nervous to think. So that's usually when the best things happen, right? No, it's fun. It's been fun just sort of getting in a little rhythm of the show now that we're kind of in a weekly, we're a little bit of a weekly thing. I kind of know what to expect every day. And it's really just being prepared for everything really helps when the things you can't prepare for happen.
I want to talk a little bit about who was most impressive over the weekend. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of candidates there. But before that, one of the things people like to hear, coaching changes. And I think there's some things that tie together there. Impressive performances and unimpressive ones, some that could have put some coaches in danger. But it has come to my attention, Pete, that we have in our midst the Grim Reaper. We have in our midst on this podcast the black cloud, the proverbial black cloud, an unexpected one, as it were. For those people of a certain age who might have liked mindless cartoons, if you remember, I think it was the new Flintstones where they had this Bad Luck Schleprock character, and he would go around, wellsy, woo-woo, and something awful would befall the people who were in the vicinity of Bad Luck Schleprock. And with that, I introduce to you one of our fine producers, typically a ray of sunshine, but in this case, a little Bad Luck Schleprock quality. I present to you Sarah, the coaching Grim Reaper, Nebraska fan, Arizona State alum. She's 2 for 2 in getting her coaches whacked over the last 2 weekends. Sarah, what do you have to say for yourself?
I am so sorry. It's been a tough week.
Yeah. Are you getting an MBA at Georgia Tech?
Yeah, no relation anywhere else. Yeah, I got my master's from ASU and then I'm from Nebraska. So apparently I'm just the Grim Reaper of coaches.
Pete mentioned Georgia Tech. Have you considered Auburn?
Yes.
Any postgraduate studies?
Online classes?
I'll go get my PhD real quick. help everyone out.
Sarah, I kid because we don't. You're one of the nicest people in the world. But Grammy has become a. We're gonna have to have Grammy on the podcast. Yeah, Sarah's grandmother, who's an ardent Nebraska fan, and typically in Scott Frost's tenure at Nebraska, what would have happened in the Oklahoma game is that they would have played, they would have been ahead, and then they would have had a punt hit the up back in the butt and bounce back for an Oklahoma touchdown. There would have been some type of bad call that would have gone against them, and Nebraska would have lost by 4. Instead, they lost by 10,000. But Grammy has this in perspective, Sarah. What was the line that Grammy delivered to you as Dylan Gabriel and the Sooners were wreaking havoc on the Big Red Thrashing Machine Saturday?
She said, and I quote, "It's okay. We're just defrosting."
That's good.
I know. She's punny, man. She is with it.
That would be a great newspaper headline.
Yeah, she said.
Like in the Lincoln Star, like defrosted.
I know. Wouldn't it have been?
That's a good headline. Wow.
But Sarah's
got to get her on Twitter.
Yeah, Sarah's other alma mater, the Herm Edwards experiment. And Herm is a great guy. Everybody knows that who's worked with him at ESPN. But it just never really worked. It was okay at times, but they've got the cloud of the NCAA investigation. And then the loss to Eastern Michigan. What has to be done eventually should be done immediately, to quote Jeremy Foley, the old Florida athletic director from back in the day. Can't really blame them. The athletic director at Arizona State, you know, is Herm's former agent. It just never seemed like the right fit. And it seems like probably a little overdue in making the move. And it gives Arizona State an opportunity to start the process, as Nebraska has, of formalizing their search for their next coach.
Yeah, it's interesting that in the framing of all this, so the thing I'm most curious about, I guess, going forward, Reese, is what the finances look like on this. Herm was owed a pretty healthy chunk of money, and when you look at how this is going to work going forward, you wonder how much basically Ray Anderson is going to take care of his guy in this. You know, like they obviously mutually agreed to part ways, which means there'll be some type of, I assume, mutual separation agreement. The thought had been they were going to wait for the notice of allegations to come, and then they could have just fired him for cause, or could have stepped down because cause was coming. There is zero people at Arizona State, on staff, former staff, or at the NCAA, who think this investigation is just going to sort of blow away. Now, with the changing paradigms of the punishment structure, nobody knows exactly how much they're going to be punished, but the cheating was so obvious and blatant, and they had so many people who put together that dossier that were willing to blow the whistle, that it is going to be a big, significant case. And Arizona State was totally unaffected by that. And what they were affected by was losing to Eastern Michigan, which gives you a little peek into their soul. I believe Arizona State is the second most penalized by the NCAA program athletic department in college athletics, I believe, by behind SMU, and maybe the most in the Power Five. And so right now that gives you a little window into how their athletic department views it. All right, you could cheat like a bandit, get caught, have half your staff dime out the coach, be amid a huge NCAA investigation that the coach calls a review, but then, oh, we lost Eastern Michigan. Whoa, can't have that. So look, this is the college athletics machine that has arrived and been created, and it's where we are. But it's been interesting to see that Michael Crow, the president of Arizona State, had some comments after that Eastern Michigan game to one of the local reporters that sort of gave a little window into this was time. And Ray Anderson, who made like, do you remember the day Herm Edwards was hired?
Mm-hmm.
Like, on a list of like shocking hires, how high up was that for you?
I didn't see it coming at all. I mean, it was like completely off the radar.
Yeah. It was one of those, like, I almost believed it because like nobody would have made it up if that makes sense. So, and this is obviously, you know, Ray Anderson having faith in Herm Edwards, who has, you know, great track record. The actual coaching part of Herm Edwards' tenure wasn't bad. Like, they beat a majority until Saturday. They beat a majority of the teams they should have. They kind of played like a conservative NFL style.
Yeah.
They had actually some really good coordinators. Tony White, who's doing a great job at Syracuse, was there for a little while as an assistant. That 3-3-5 has really jump-started that program and helped them start 3-0. Danny Gonzalez from San Diego State was the DC. He's the head coach at New Mexico, trying to turn that thing around. But, like, Herm was like a professional as a coach in a lot of ways. And that's why I think like the coaching part was good. So that's why it was probably better than maybe some people thought it would be a disaster. But ultimately, he lent too much power to Antonio Pierce. Pierce sort of started running off the assistant coaches who wouldn't cheat. And that's where all the tension started. And that's where Herm failed as a coach.
I just want to say, let me ask you this, because it's my perception. And a lot of this is the personal regard that I have for Herm and his standards and his character. Sure. My perception of this does not absolve him of any blame whatsoever. He's the head coach. And I don't want to say behind his back, but he wasn't engaged in what the rules were supposed to be and wasn't really on top of it. Is that fair? Or is it, from your journalistic and investigative reporter skills, was it more than that, and that he looked and said, this is what everyone else is doing. It's not going to be a big deal because there are a lot of other Pac-12 schools that are doing this during the COVID restriction time. So it's not a big deal. Which was it, from the best of what you've been able to ascertain?
So from viewing the dossier that was sent to the NCAA and from my reporting, he wasn't leading the charge on the cheating, but he had knowledge of it and participated in it directly. He met with players in his office when recruits couldn't be on campus. There's a picture of him in the weight room with a really highly regarded recruit from one state over who went to a big time school. And like, so there was no like, oh, I had my head in the sand and I didn't know. And it really wasn't even like, do what you want to. I don't want to know. He was involved and engaged at the moments he had to be. He wasn't leading the charge, but he was a participant. Okay. And that will come out in the NCAA investigation into all this. But the thing about Herm is he stuck around for a while, made $4 million more bucks. So his buyout, if they just tried to fire him, would have been, they owed him $8 million to fire him. Now they are not going to pay him $8 million. Like, I just don't think that's going to, I don't think that's going to happen. I had someone in Arizona tell me last night, like, the financial resolution of this is to be determined, which is probably smart. And they'll get FOIA'd in 2 years when, you know, and it'll be revealed. But it's, it has been an embarrassing stretch. That the people I feel the worst for are Arizona State fans, right? Because you could just feel this program just absolutely being gutted piece by piece, transfer by transfer, coach who left by coach who left. You know, like, Zach Hill from Boise was a good offensive coordinator. He got run out. They hired all these young gun assistants to, you know, to go follow in line with what Pierce wanted. Their careers took drastic turns in that. And meanwhile, if you're a Sun Devil fan and you want to show up and cheer on your team, you lose Jaden Daniels. You lose players to Florida State, Johnny Wilson. He's pretty good, right?
He had a good night Friday night.
A good Friday night. Talented guy, 4-star from Southern California. You can see why. I mean, 6'7", that catch in the back of the end zone was unbelievable. You lost one of your best linebackers to USC. You lost another receiver. It has to hurt as a fan to watch all of your best players just conga line out of your program. So you knew whether you could say they were going to lose to Eastern Michigan or not, you don't know, but you knew this was coming. There was going to, you can't lose 7 of your 10 best players. And that's sort of ballparking, right? And their best D lineman went to Louisville. You don't have like the all conference level D tackles just rolling in any place that's not named, you know, USC or Utah in the Pac-12. So you could feel this coming. So it just has to be a bad feeling. Like when you're a fan showing up for the season where your coach is going to get fired and the on-field results sort of match your worst fears. So I have a lot of empathy. We'll talk about it more as we go on. It is a sleeping giant and it's asleep for a reason. And it's because of bad leadership there. And it will be interesting to see how from the president's level down, they attempt to wake that up, because there's a reason why if you've been asleep for a few decades, there's usually a reason why you're asleep.
They've been a sleeping giant pretty much forever. They're one of the programs that can't get it right. The conference issue, I think, is significant for them going forward in terms of whether they're ever going to become this giant. I think there's a little bit of a misconception about how attractive it is. My old buddy Mark May, whose jersey you can see right up there, has made his home in Arizona for years, and he has for years said, why wouldn't everybody want to go to Arizona State and play? And I know it's attractive, and I know it could be good, but a lot of people don't want to go that far away from home when they don't know what they're getting. When you go across the country to Ohio State or Alabama or even Clemson, you know what you're getting. If you travel from all over or go where it's not easy for your family to see you play or something, you don't know what you're getting at Arizona State. So it's going to take a little while. It's going to take the proper leadership, as you mentioned, and it's going to take the right coach who wants to stay there. So who is that guy? Who is the best fit among, or a list of guys among your fit who could do that at Arizona State, depending on what the sanctions might be, if there are indeed hefty sanctions other than, you know, just being fined or something?
Yeah. Well, the sanction thing is like a whole other conversation, because as this college basketball thing is unfolded, and we just passed the 5-year anniversary of it on September 17th, which is mind bending considering there's about 4 teams that haven't, I don't even think one of the teams has got their notice validations yet. So anyway, like the NCAA process moves slow, and they've changed the goalposts on what punishments can be that may work in Arizona. It's a good time to be a cheater, basically. Cause they keep moving the goalposts on what the rules are and what can happen. So names for Arizona State, and that will be parsed a lot by the coaches and by their representatives, quite frankly, as they try to figure out what would happen. But a similar case to keep in mind is like the Tennessee case, if you will. Now, I don't think they're going to have 10 or whatever it was level ones there, but like it was just as blatant and they did it for just as long. And since they caught them so bad, don't be surprised if the NCAA wants to, the NCAA, which enforcement has had a bad run. They may be a little bit performative about how they handle it like they were in Tennessee. So that said, I put out a list last night. I won't read all 12 names, but I do think one really interesting name that got a lot of buzz in your neck of the woods, Reese, is Brian Harsin, an accomplished West Coast coach who needs an exit strategy. It's not working. There's no AD. Like, it just, that makes way too much sense to me. Put him back in his wheelhouse, put him in place he's comfortable. He's not a bad coach because Auburn tried to subvert him and run him out. So that to me is the most intriguing. I have Kalani Sitake. Do they take a run at Jonathan Smith, who has proven to be one of the best coaches on the West Coast the past 5 years? In the look, they need a slow, methodical build back. And Jonathan Smith has done that through evaluations, through quarterback development. He's done an elite job. I think Tom Herman's a really interesting name there. I think you can, you know, he's a proven quarterback tutor from Ohio State, Houston. You in he had Texas as a top 25 team consistently. So I think there would be some fit there, and I think he would be a little bit of an energy jolt. And quite frankly, that program needs to be modernized. Herm was not the best, you know, college coach to modernize the program. It needs to be shaken up and pushed forward. He really did that at Houston. I'm sure you remember that, Reese, during his time there. He helped pull them to the point where they were building and getting ready for the Big 12. He woke up every day trying to do that. Hard to ignore Troy Calhoun, even though the wheels of our bandwagon fell off in Laramie on Friday night.
They're still good. They're still a good team.
Oh yeah, they'll win 10 games.
Yeah, they're still going to win 10. Yeah.
And they're not doing it with better players than most of the people they play, which is the sign of a great coach. Charles Huff is a guy at the moment, even though they lost in overtime at Bowling Green on Saturday. Certainly he's, you know, he's someone who is going to be on radars for some of these jobs that open. And then I have Matt Entz from North Dakota State. I don't think you can ignore that tree with the success Chris Kleiman's having right now in the Midwest. I like Sean Lewis at Kent State. I just think he's done a good job there. He's defied history. That's hard to do. He would bring a very defined style. You can say, hey, come play in the desert and play fast. And there's enough skill and quarterback talent out there. Then I have Bill O'Brien, Todd Monken, Derek Mason, who's at Oklahoma State now, and then Alex Grinch. If you are good at USC, the coordinator is going to get hired somewhere. Grinch has had Power 5 opportunities that he's turned down before. So anyway, I think that list, and they probably don't get past some of the early part of it. Who would you hire, Reese?
I'd probably hire Harsin, because I think he's a really good coach who is not so good that he transcends fit. And there are very few of those guys. There are probably three, four, five guys, if that many, who transcend fit, can win anywhere. Brian can't do that at Auburn. Maybe another SEC school he could have, but I mean, that's not a good football team right now. We said before the season, or I did anyway, this was ending this year one way or the other. Either Auburn had a really good year and he took another job, or they would run him off. This could be the best of both worlds, and you'd be getting a guy who's, you know, like in his 10th year as a head coach, he's like 82 and 31. He knows the West Coast. I think that would probably be the guy I would look at first, because you would have some experience and some stability. And much like I talked about the difficulty for the recruits there, not knowing what you're getting if you went to Arizona State, to some degree, Arizona State would know what it's getting in Brian Harsin. So the other guys you mentioned on that list, there's some terrific names there, but that's probably where I would go first, because I would need someone who stability, and certainly by his time at Auburn, he's been through some stuff. And not only that, he's been a coordinator at Texas, short period of time. But if you're a coordinator at Texas and spend a short period of time at Auburn, you ought to be able to weather some storms. And so I think that's a guy who I would probably go to first, and that would be the best case scenario for everybody. Georgia Tech's going to be next up on this list, right? I mean, in terms of coaching change?
Yes, and I think the question looming over Georgia Tech now is, how do you unwind it? It's not if, it's when. I would expect Todd Stansbury, the athletic director, sometime, you know, before Columbus Day, to be given his walking papers. And that would give that university, which has a new president who came from George Mason and is aggressive, the time to reinstall a new AD who can then make the hire to align with the new coach. So that was a dark night for Georgia Tech football. I believe they got their third punt blocked of the season. It's just not an engaged outfit right now. Look, that's a hard job. And I'm sure we'll dive into that very soon deeper on a podcast, but the change is needed. Change is obvious. And there will be an athletic director coach change, you know, imminently. I would say I talked to an AD on Sunday, brought up an interesting point. He said he hates it to where firing coaches early has become a strategic advantage. Mm-hmm. But guess what? Firing your coach early has become a strategic advantage. So, and quite frankly, Brian Harsin probably is going to get exited quick enough at Auburn. And this is, you know, there's games to play, and this is a bit of a guess, but the results on Saturday made a bad situation worse, where he could get hired early enough mm-hmm. at Arizona State to where you could do what Clay Helton did, what Joey McGuire did, what Jim Mora did, and get a month jump on your new job. Tom Herman obviously gives him that asset. I saw Dan Mullen's name floated around. I don't know Mullen's desires right now to jump back in. He's obviously doing a great job as an analyst for us at ESPN, and he's a good name. I mean, you can't argue with the results over mm-hmm. you know, over the span, especially sort of lifting Mississippi State from the dredges. We are going to, my wife likes to joke, people get fired on Sundays because it's usually like when we spend a little family time together and it can be disrupted by phone calls. But we're going to have a few more Black Sundays, I think, before Columbus Day.
Is your son, do you think your son's first words will be fired? Dad, who got whacked? Who's about to get whacked, Dad?
I hope not. I hope it's mom. That would be deserved. And we did just buy on Amazon a bunch of like stuffed balls. Now Teddy Thamel's 7 months old, profiles as a nose tackle right now. We'll see if he sticks that. And he's very good at taking the balls and trying to eat them and shoving them in his mouth. He's so proficient, but he likes to throw them off his high chair and watch them bounce. And then I go pick them up and put them back in. And then he throws them off again and watches them bounce away. So yes, he does have a little like faux cell phone. So Kate sent me a very cute picture on Saturday. She was like, Teddy's getting some scoops on Saturday morning. I told him to watch his back. So.
So much about a coaching change, I think, for athletic. The one caveat I would offer with Harsin is it's going so sideways and the whole coup attempt last year at Auburn, silly as it might have been and as vacuous as it might have been, still creates a perception among your fan base. The only thing I would worry about with Harsin from that standpoint is not so much about doing the job, but about winning the press conference. These guys, so many of them, university presidents, athletic directors, many of them are caught up in that. They get almost debilitated by what will the reaction on social media be? What will our, you know, donors say about this or that? Sometimes that stops hires that appear to be imminent. There's, you know, one pretty high mm-hmm. profile one in the last couple of years that was going to happen and didn't because of that reason. That said, not that this was like that, but I don't know that even with his success at Sioux Falls that everybody knew who Kalen DeBoer was, but they're going to know soon. They're going to know soon after what Washington did on the subject of sleeping giants who've been a little, who've hit the snooze button on and off for the last several years for sure. They took apart old Sparty Saturday night, and that was a really impressive performance. Shows the power of getting the right coach. I know it's early in the season. It's one game. I get that. But you get a coach with a plan. You use the transfer portal to get a veteran quarterback, and you can kind of get it going. Maybe not to the level of going to the playoff or anything like that, but you can kind of build some positive momentum quickly if you do those two things well. And the early returns suggest that Washington has done just that.
Yeah, look, and we've said this on the podcast before. Kalen DeBoer has won at every one stoplight town, every NAIA school, every Division II school that he's stopped at. And at a certain point, you can't cast that as coincidence. I believe this in college football. I also believe in college basketball. If you can figure out a way to win at lower levels, you can figure out a way to win at higher levels. I think Lance Leipold is another example of that. I'm sure we're going to talk about them a little bit later today. Michael Penix healthy with Kalen DeBoer as coordinator is a lethal combination. And they took Indiana football to, you know, unbelievable heights back in, I believe that was 2020, that COVID year when Indiana had that run and they beat Michigan. And Penix is a real deal guy. He had profiled as an NFL prospect and he had just gotten dinged up and the system didn't sync up with him. So look, what DeBoer has done is unbelievable, but I think what we're learning about Washington was there was actually a bunch of talent there with Jimmy Lake and it just for one reason or another wasn't maximized. Michigan State, who had pushed some people around last year, didn't push anybody around. And you look at Jalen Berger had 27 yards rushing on 13 carries. Broussard had 3 yards rushing on 4 carries. Washington won in the trenches. Somewhere Steve Entman was smiling on Saturday night in suburban Seattle because they were just on both sides of the ball. They simply pushed them around. And that's a credit to reestablishing the culture. I give William Inge, the defensive coordinator at Washington, who came from Fresno with DeBoer, a lot of credit for just completely emasculating that Michigan State offense. Remember, they scored 14 in the fourth, too. Like that, you look at 39-28 and you're like, oh, yeah, nope, that was not a game. It was simply not a game. And yeah, like all of a sudden we need to like reframe the conversation around Washington as someone who should be able to compete for the Pac-12 title. They have Stanford at UCLA, at Arizona State, Arizona at home, at Cal. So they will be favored in all of those games. And there's no USC on their schedule. They have a trip to Austin, which right now I'm feeling like could have some of those old Washington, Oregon vibes of two mm-hmm. teams maybe in the top 15, you know, playing for high stakes in the North and in a spot in that title game. And in a good, healthy, functioning Washington is good for college football. There's a lot of talent in Seattle. It's a great place to go to college. It is a place that you can win the national title at if you have the right guy there. And the very early signs under Kalen DeBoer is that he is going to be someone who can unlock Washington as a Pac-12 contender at the highest level. And that's fun to see.
One of the things from the offseason with the disruption of the Pac-12 with the impending departure of USC and UCLA is just how strong is the league? How attractive are they? So there's a little irony in the fact that Washington looks really good. I think Oregon State is really good. Speaking of bandwagons, I've hopped aboard the Beavers bandwagon a little bit early, and I don't know that I believe they can beat SC this week, but SC better be careful. Going to Corvallis with a veteran team, they look solid. Cal acquitted itself well against Notre Dame. I know Notre Dame has some issues. There are several teams. Arizona's much improved. We know Utah's good. A lot of these teams that have been left behind by the USC-UCLA departure and certainly Oregon's rebound against BYU that I left out when I was listing teams there. But the teams left behind have performed well in the first few weeks of September and kind of have given a little jolt of energy to the Pac-12. Washington's leading the charge, and Oregon State might be right there beside them by this weekend. And the way Oregon played against a very good BYU team on Saturday helped the cause too.
Yeah, I think one thing to remember when we're thinking about Oregon State and USC, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more this week, Reese, is that they led in the Coliseum in the fourth quarter last year, 42-17. The game ended 45-27, but they absolutely ragdolled USC. And I don't think USC's defense has really been tested yet. And this will be a significant test for that defense. Chance Nolan sashayed his way through the Coliseum one way down the field and back last season. And so Corvallis is going to be a difficult place to play. That is going to be the single biggest day on the campus of Oregon State this year. They're going to be riled up. Pac-12 network cameras will be fired up and ready to go. And I'm saying that I will probably be stealing someone's password late Saturday night in order to tune in on my laptop. So somewhere Larry Scott is sleeping on a pile of money, snickering at the chaos that his reign has caused. But I think like what a moment, and all right, USC, we knew your offense was going to be good from the pieces. We knew because of Lincoln's play calling and Caleb, Jordan Addison, Rice, Williams, everybody else who came in, Mario Williams, obviously not Caleb, mm-hmm. everybody else who came in, you were going to do what you were doing. Now, let's see if that offensive line can, on a fourth and two, get a push against the veteran Beaver defense, you know, crowd noise, like all those types of things. You are actually going to be tested to the fullest this weekend. That's not a knock on Fresno, but this is, you can say, okay, last year, this was a disaster. Let's see what it looks like this year, especially on the defensive side of the ball. There's still a lot of question marks. I don't think that Stanford game and all the interceptions really answered the questions about USC's defense. It may have masked them in some ways. So, but on the macro point, like the Pac-12 has to be feeling, you know, especially after Utah losing in the way it did and the hardest possible way, like they have to be feeling pretty good about just being vibrant and relevant right now.
I agree with you on the USC defense. I called that game, the Stanford SC game, and there are pieces on the USC defense that are good. Some really good players over there. But Stanford moved the ball basically at will and imploded when they got in the red zone with sort of unconscionable turnovers. They had two fumbles. They had, you know, had a pick on the opening drive, and then they had another one in the end zone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they put up, I'm going to pull it up right here. I think they had close to 500 yards of offense against them.
While you're looking that up, how was USC's D-line? Like, did you feel like their D-line dominated the line of scrimmage against a pedestrian Stanford O-line?
No way. Okay. Not even close. I mean, Stanford had 221 yards rushing, average nearly 5 yards a carry. They put up 441 yards. Now, to be fair, Stanford had hidden the fact that they had incorporated a great deal of their Wake Forest stuff, the slow mesh RPO type game. That was not something they'd put on tape, and they'd kept it a closely guarded secret for the most part. So I do want to acknowledge that USC was seeing something on offense that they had not seen from the tape the week before, unless they had a spy and somebody had leaked that news to them and they had prepped it a little bit. They certainly hadn't seen Stanford do it.
And Jacksonville State's spy, the one Rich Rod ferreted out.
yeah, exactly. So there's that. But I thought Stanford's offensive line handled USC's D line just fine. So that gives you a little pause for this week and some of the other games. But you're going to have to be really, really good on offense and hope you force SC's offense into making some mistakes, turnovers or something, in order to put some heat on them, because they look legit. And the one thing that Lincoln Riley said is that when he came into the program, a couple of areas of the team were in pretty good shape personnel-wise, and one of those was offensive line. So they got all these skill guys to go around, and the offensive line was, he already felt pretty good about it. And they also added a piece or two there as well. So the offense is going to be able to mask a multitude of sins from their defense. But I agree with you. I think the defense has some question marks yet.
Guess the spread on that game, Reese.
I've peaked. I would love to see.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, I peaked. Right. It's like six and a hook, isn't it?
Six and a hook,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have thought it was maybe 11. Now, and that's not a knock on Oregon State. Betting is perception more than reality, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so that's it. I think there will be big money on the Trojans because people have seen them march up and down the field on Saturday night. And I have a feeling our old friend Coach Corso may be saying, not so fast, my friends.
it's an early leader. I mean, who knows? I don't even want to ask what my record on the picks is right now.
Well, but if you had a bad week, that means I had a good week.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if I had a good week or a bad week, but I do know.
Taylor, how did we do?
Early leader in the clubhouse for my Superdog Saturday morning. And I always go last and try to balance the country and make sure that we've looked in a lot of different places. But Oregon State's a leader in the clubhouse for me to take the six and a hook at home.
All right. Beef Nation, come aboard. Taylor, do we have our records? Did you tabulate that yet?
I did tabulate them. Reese went 3-7. Pete, you went 4-6. Bill, 5-5. I went 6-5. And Sarah, 7-3.
Sarah!
Just cleaning up around here.
Okay, Sarah's getting her tips from her grandma, I'm convinced. She's not making the picks herself.
Sarah, you're getting coaches fired. You're crushing us in the picks. Sarah might be the most powerful person in college football. She's the puppet master. She's orchestrating everything.
I mean, I don't know what to tell you. I'm just the most powerful woman in college football at the moment.
And apparently. From Bristol, too. She's really, you know, a lot of conspiracy theories about ESPN running the sport. It's really Sarah in the chair.
Pete, let's wrap up. Let's do a little rapid fire here. I'm going to give you a few categories and just a reaction. And I'll give you mine. Most impressive performance last weekend.
You go first.
My most impressive we've talked about is Washington, so I'll go to plan B and say Penn State. Auburn's got all kinds of quarterback problems, but Penn State went in and physical, tough, dominated that game. Clifford took a massive hit. I think it was Owen Papo early who welcomed him to Jordan-Hare, and he popped up, and they just kept dominating. So I'll say Washington first. Penn State was 1A. I think that was the most impressive thing I saw.
I'm going to say Oklahoma. There's been a lot of Nebraska talk, but Brent Venables in his third game as a head coach, they roll in, they give up an early score, right? You're on the road. And look, the one thing that's undefeated about Nebraska is the fans and the environment. That has not wavered, even though the product has not dictated their devotion. And Dylan Gabriel, cool as a cucumber, 2 touchdowns, no interceptions, efficient game. Eric Gray rolling on the ground, 10 yards a clip. I just really think that is a declaration of a lot of people thought because Oklahoma didn't have a ton of guys on the all Big 12 team going into the season. And there was just a lot of new personnel and a couple guys took that West Coast trip to LA to the 213 for some NIL cash. Oklahoma looks like they're going to be just fine going into Big 12 play, and in Red River, let's hope maybe the return of Quinn Ewers really shapes that up to be an epic game. So Boomer Sooner, they roll.
And that could be a potential game day sight for sure. And if Ewers is back and Gabriel's spinning the bean, when it's
Texas State Fair. Can you imagine what McAfee would eat at the
State
Fair? Can you imagine what McAfee would eat?
A corny dog, various...
Deep fried
Oreos, various culinary delights that are dipped in batter and fried. Yeah, I'm there for that too. Bandwagon that you won't jump off of, though you realize that there are some construction roads ahead this weekend. I'm going to say Minnesota. I've been on Minnesota in the running game. I thought Kirk Shiraka coming back would help Tanner Morgan. I know they haven't been tested. I get that. But you know what good teams do? They annihilate bad teams when they play them and get the chance. That's what Minnesota has done. That's what Minnesota did on a Saturday against Colorado. They ran wild on them. Ibrahim has looked great coming back from the Achilles injury.
Good for him, by the way.
He's up to a dozen consecutive games in which he's played, having 100 yards rushing. Michigan State's battered. They're embarrassed coming off Washington. They come back home. That's the perfect setup game for you to hop off a bandwagon and for a bandwagon to hit a pothole. And I'm going to lock in and stay on Minnesota's bandwagon this weekend. What bandwagon are you stubbornly staying aboard?
I'm going to stay aboard the Arkansas bandwagon, although they begged me to get off on Saturday by trailing the Fighting Petrinos 17-0 in the second quarter. I know this is rapid fire, but I was driving from Boone to Wake Forest, so I got to listen to some games on the radio, and then I went from Wake to Charlotte, where I stayed on Saturday night. And the tension in the – so you get to listen to local radio calls, which I love. I could spend that listening to local radio calls. It's a great way to just get a little flavor from each program. And the Hog Booth in the fourth quarter down 27-17 was a little bit of a nervous place, Reese. They went down to the sideline reporter at one point, and it was almost like he was trying to give the team a pep talk.
Can you even imagine the calamitous situation of Bob Petrino rolling in and taking the electric glide Road King Expressway out of there with a victory? That could have one game should never make or break a program. I'm going to tell you that if Bob Petrino, after all that happened, had gone into Fayetteville and beaten what is, you know, right around a top 10 Arkansas team, maybe they're in the top 10 this week. They're 10, and beating a top 10 Arkansas team, handed them their first loss. That's a program crushing. That's a soul crushing loss. And I can understand the angst that the local radio guys had over that.
Imagine how wounded that fan base would have been. Yeah, that was why I tuned in, by the way. I'm a vulture, right? I was like, oh boy, they're down in the fourth. I am listening to this. I was really hoping I could get the Missouri State call, because sometimes on Sirius you can get the local one, because that would have been, man, that would have been a pretty good 3.5 quarters for the play-by-play guy and the color guy from Missouri State. But yeah, you could feel the tension in that booth. I think Clint Stoner, the old quarterback, is in that booth. Again, I'm going in and out on the radio, so I didn't like lock in, but it was a fun listen and a great broadcast. There are some great radio broadcasts when you listen, well produced, great voices. I listened to Matt Park of Syracuse and that end of that Purdue game going over to Wake Forest. He did an awesome job there. Yeah, it's a lot. It's a great way to just get a little portrait of all these little places all around the country just by flipping through the dial.
The patron saint of the Homer radio announcer is, of course, the great Larry Munson at Georgia. And I loved that Larry said we and they, you know, I mean, just flat out, you know, no pretense. I love that from them. He would say things like, even just on a tackle in the backfield, and now we are going to knock him down in the backfield. Oh, we're going to knock him down in the backfield. Those dogs coming. You know, it's a beautiful thing. The Saturday night here, the local radio guys too. But that would have been a tough one. Okay, last one. It's early. Who are you most worried about that's a highly ranked team? Who's raised some warning signals too? Sort of like the worry meter we did on College Game Day Saturday morning.
Well, I think I have to say Clemson, right? Like their offense just hasn't gotten to a point where you feel comfortable with them playing the high-level teams that they have played under Dabo. So I just think there's been enough empirical evidence to say, you know, and Pollock said in the podcast a couple weeks ago, they kind of sleptwalked through the first half of La Tech. They have traditionally handled Wake Forest very easily, but here they are headed to Wake Forest, Wake struggled against Liberty. Liberty's pretty good, by the way. Liberty's got some skill guys. But, you know, going into Wake Forest on Saturday, you know, Wake has a better offense. They have better quarterback and they have better scheme on offense. And now it did not look good. They actually ran very little slow mesh on Saturday because Liberty's DNs were so good. And certainly Clemson has a defensive line that can just smash that scheme into pieces. But again, I have a lot of empathy for what the Clemson program has gone through with Brian Brzee's sister Ella passing. And I certainly don't want my comment about them as a program to be, you know, conflated with anything tied to that. There were some great moments in that game, especially with what Sonny Cumbie did, the Louisiana Tech head coach, wearing an Ellis Strong shirt out to the pregame warmups. But I just think if you look at that top 10, like there's still some questions hovering over the Tigers, and we may see them up close.
I think there's a great chance that we'll see them up close. The one thing that Clemson has that Wake Forest has not been able to handle, and I doubt they'll be able to handle this weekend too, is the defensive front. It's the one thing that, as difficult as that scheme is to play, that can totally wreck it. If you can send your defensive lineman into the backfield and just swallow the slow mesh or the quarterback, if they don't run it, you have a hard time out scheming anything else. That's where Clemson will exert its authority. It might be a low scoring game if Clemson can't get its offense together, but I think Clemson's defense will probably control that game. Louisiana Tech and Sonny Cumbie, in addition to wearing the Ella Strong shirt, players writing a letter, personal letter to Brian Brzee on the passing of his sister Ella, and delivering those in the box. That was such a poignant image to see that. And Dabo was moved by it, appreciative of it, and it showed great class. And I think I joke a lot of times, and while you are the more cynical of the two of us, admittedly, and that's sort of been a running joke with us, I am cynical about coaches, and have even had conversations with coaches when they say things like, our number one job is to develop young men. I always roll my eyes and say, no, it's not. Your number one job is to win games. And it is. It still is. But it doesn't mean that those two things are mutually exclusive, that you can't have an impact on someone's life while you are trying to win games in coaching. And in this particular instance, I can't think of a recent gesture that was more meaningful or more heartfelt or more of a proverbial life lesson of how to be and how to treat people than what Sonny did with his players in relation to Brian's loss. And, you know, I can't even fathom the type of pain that the Brzee family is going through, and our condolences and our prayers continue to be with them. And whenever Brian feels like it's right, we look forward to seeing him, you know, back on the field for Clemson. My guess is it'll be this weekend. If it's not, it's okay. You know, I mean, it's a difficult thing, and everybody grieves in their own way and on their own timetable. So, but as it pertains to football, I love Dave Clawson. I think he is a brilliant head coach. And I think this is, year in and year out, the worst possible matchup that they could ever fathom. And I just don't think they have an answer for the physical superiority that the Clemson defensive line will have against them. And it'll ultimately lead to Clemson setting up a showdown next week with North Carolina State. I'm beaten, I think.
So who's your team, Reese, that you don't, that you're skeptical of in the top 10?
It's Clemson. I mean, okay. there's not really another choice, but I would also say, Pete, I would also say Arkansas is in that list too. They do a lot of great things, but they've had some injuries. They've lost Jalen Catalan, who was an All-American mm-hmm. candidate at defensive back. People move the ball on him. So I'm a little skeptical of Arkansas too. Clemson would be first, probably because the expectations are higher mm-hmm. for Clemson in terms of making the playoff. But another team that I'm a little skeptical of right now and wanting to see a little bit more on the defensive side of the ball, especially, is Arkansas. But I also want to give Arkansas a little bit of a break because of the rhythm of the season last week. You start with a really physical and good Cincinnati team. It really didn't have its best day on Saturday, but pulled it out and got the old victory bell from Miami, Ohio. Arkansas starts with Cincinnati. Then they follow up by opening conference play against South Carolina. Spencer Rattler coming in, knowing that there's some pressure there, wanting to do something. Got A&M this week, so you have the sandwich game. You have Petrino, who, you know, pulled out every stop in the world, you know, to try to make that game competitive, and he did. All credit to him and his staff and his players. So I'll give him a little bit of a pass on just the rhythm of the season, exhaling a little bit from the first 2 weeks, which were challenging, a little peek ahead to a big game. It's always a big game for them against A&M. So I'm going to give them a little bit of a break, but I have had my antenna raised just a hair on Arkansas too, among top 10 teams. So
Oklahoma State's next game, 10-1, is at Baylor. They blew out Pine Bluff and then have a week off before then. And that I'm skeptical of them, if only because Eastern Michigan beat Arizona State more handily than they did at home.
It's reasonable, I think, for all of those teams right now. And, you know, Oklahoma State particularly seems to, for whatever reason, you can catch them early. And sometimes things don't go as well for them early as it does later. But, you know, I think that's a really intriguing game as well coming up. A lot of good games on the first that week, too. Kansas has Duke this week. We'll dive into that a little bit more as we get there. People upset with us for not going to Kansas. It's early to get to Larry Town in football. Leipold has to keep it up a little bit more. I need a little bit more than 3-0 and beating up on a Houston team that's having fights on the sideline. So, they whooped them.
Kansas fans wanted us good. To show
I was high. Yeah. I was high on Houston in the preseason, but they haven't lived up to it.
There were some reasons. Yeah. If Kansas fans are mad at us showing up, they should have shown up the last 20 years for Kansas football. So again, that's no knock on Lance Leipold, but they've done that is a Lazarus like resurrection there. Considering when he showed up in May of last year, but I just think game day brings with it a certain pulse. And I don't know if that pulse has gone through since the Fighting Manginos were in town there.
But they should build a statue to Mangino for what he did there, man. I mean, they should name the field after him or something. I know there were some other issues there at the end, but
yeah,
as far as the results on the field,
yeah,
remarkable for sure. So our picks are going to get better eventually. I promise. I hope anyway. Can't get worse. And Sarah, I don't think she has any more alma maters, so maybe no more coaches will be fired on her watch just because of the gloom and doom that she brings only to your coaching future and every other aspect of life. She is a ray of sunshine on this podcast with a bunch of cantankerous, grumpy old guys, but she's the one that keeps getting coaches whacked. So podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts 3 times a week. We'll have guests coming up later on. I'm not sure who we're getting. I think we'll get somebody from Game Day, maybe even get a little coaching expertise in here. So we appreciate you listening. Continue to listen. Get your podcasts everywhere you need them. And we're still looking for submissions for Pete Thamel's little nuggets of goodness every Saturday morning on College Game Day. We haven't quite hit on anything yet. So keep those submissions coming.